Bob? Ready? Okay, and James, if we have a problem with this, let us know. Okay, so let's go ahead and call the October 23rd meeting of the Mill Creek City Council to order. And as always, we will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call.
Mayor Brewitt.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Holtzclaw.
Here.
Councilmember Bond. Councilmember Todd.
Here.
Councilmember Cavallari.
Here.
Councilmember Mead.
Here.
Councilmember Steckler.
Here.
Councilmember Bond informed us he's still on vacation, so may we have a motion to excuse his absence?
Motion to excuse.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. First up is audience communication, and we have two people signed up. First up is David Lee. Name and address.
David Lee. My address is 12214 Southeast 18th Place, Bellevue, Washington, 98005. I'm here. I'm the developer, owner, builder of Clock Tower Self-Storage and Mill Creek Commons. And I'm here to discuss the trail to the north of our clock tower storage facility. I've sent pictures and communicated emails to city council members, and then I've met with the she's no longer here.
City manager.
City manager. Thank you. Police department and planning department, expressing my concerns about this trail. This trail was a required of one of my development items that I had to do, and I asked, you know, at that time, I go, I'd rather just give $50,000 to the park department instead of doing this trail. 16 years, dead-end trail, nobody on it. Spent tens of thousands of dollars cleaning it up, homeless people. It's perfect for homeless people. It's dark. It's next to a bus stop. It's next to QFC. Thousands and thousands of beer cans littered the site and homeless people all along the stream. I'd always clean them up. I'd go to Mill Creek Police Department, and they were always great, very proactive and helpful, and they always took care of the situation. And then the daycare to the west of us got developed, and so finally a year ago, the trail was extended to 9th. And we sat down, you know, with the people I mentioned, and, you know, I said, you know, I'm really concerned. It's a perfect environment for homeless people. And about 3 weeks ago, I was met with our property management company, and we had to do a lot of maintenance along Bothell Everett Highway. And I walked down the trail, and I saw somebody camping there. And I said, listen, you got to get out of here. There's a daycare here. I'm going to call the police. I'll give you $50 to move now. So I gave him a half an hour. He moved out, gave him his $50, and off he went. And then I went back to look at the landscape work to see if it was done to my satisfaction. I went down, and I looked, and there I saw this tent with just garbage everywhere. And then I walked down the trail to the west, and I saw three homeless camps on the other side of Penny Creek. And one I could tell was a fresh camp. So I immediately went to the police department, said, hey, we got homeless people, you know, on the trail. And I got an email from Glenn, and he said, you know, that tent on your side was definitely abandoned. And so I went back last Friday, and sure enough, the tent was abandoned. And then the other active site on the other side of the stream was removed. Nobody was there. So once again, kudos to the Mill Creek Police Department. But the reason why I'm here is I'm concerned about my liability. The city of Mill Creek required me to build the trail. Nobody could build the trail within you know, close to the stream, but apparently jurisdictions can, but not developers. So I'm required to maintain the trail. I'm required to build the trail. And I'm required to clean the trail. And what happens if somebody gets hurt on the trail? What happens if somebody gets attacked on the trail? And it's my land, and it's for the benefit of the city, not for the benefit of me. Who's going to get sued? And that's my concern. And you know, when this requirement was written, 1975, there was no such thing as homelessness. And now we have an epidemic of opioid use and homelessness. And believe me, I have cleaned out over 30 camps on our property. And there are hypodermic needles, there are knives. It runs the gamut. And I as a landowner, I don't want to take that liability. And for the few, I mean, I've owned this property for over 18 years, and the trail's been active for 17 years since we've opened the property. I've seen one person on the trail. And so my question and my hope is that the city of Mill Creek will help and say, hey, if, you know, and I've asked for the city just to take over ownership. If this is what you guys want, you really want, then you take it. I'll give you a deed. You take the trail. I don't want the liability. It's just not worth it. And that's all I wanted to say. I wanted to voice my concern. I wanted to show up in person because this is a terrible issue. And this really hit home when, you know, these two homeless people killed these two students in Iowa. And that's when I kind of, the light bulb went off. I was like, man, I don't want to be in this. I don't want to be in that position. The city of Mill Creek wants to take that liability, fine, but I'm done. So that's all I wanted to say. All right, thank you for your time.
We'll be discussing what you saw on the agenda, panhandling, and other issues later this evening. Okay, Jennifer?
Good evening, Jennifer Pulowski. 4125 138th Street Southeast. I recently became aware of a proposal to build a third apartment complex at East Gateway Urban Village, also known as The Farm. The original vision for East Gateway Urban Village was to bring businesses to our community to generate revenue without raising taxes. The council cannot overlook the fact that Mill Creek residents pay one of the most highest local taxes in the state of Washington. As our representatives, shouldn't you be creating tax opportunities instead of taxing us out of our homes? Mill Creek is a lovely bedroom community, a place where many residents want to raise their families, but to be successful, the council needs to ensure revenue is generated to cover costs of running the city. The purchasing power of our residents needs to be concentrated in Mill Creek, but with a lack of attractive businesses, neighboring cities such as Everett and Linwood reap the revenue rewards. Not only is the farm not generating adequate tax revenue, Mill Creek residents will have to contend with long-term effects of congestion in the city and overcrowding at schools that this apartment complex will bring to our community. Unincorporated Snohomish, Everett, and Bothell are developing apartments at the boundary lines of Mill Creek. These renters, although not living in Mill Creek, must use city roads to get to their destination, and they must be educated in a portable. Why is the council contributing to this congestion and overcrowding by adding more apartments within city limits? Traffic on Ontario roads is unsustainable. The north-south traffic on 35th is so bad, Snohomish County in recent past denied developments due to congestion. Commuters desperately trying to just move, seek shortcuts through neighborhoods, putting our children playing outside their homes at risk. Safety is a real concern. The elimination of the Mill Creek Police Department satellite office in the area of the farm gives the appearance that the City Council is not concerned with the security of its constituents, or at least residents who live outside Old Mill Creek. Rapid growth will stretch police and fire to the point of being ineffective. The risk of diminished response times from our first responders is a reality as police deal with an increase in gang violence, drug activity, and violent incident crime in and around the city. Is the council prepared to ask residents to pay for shortfalls in police and fire services resulting from the rapid influx and growth to this area? Mill Creek annexed this property to control development and ensure opportunities existed to benefit our community. Over 12 years, this village has been approved in a piecemeal fashion, lacking revenue prospects while burdening roads, urban services, and schools. Bottom line, your constituents don't want more apartments. They don't want more taxes to cover irresponsible fiscal decisions. They want to be assured their families are safe. They want their children educated in a classroom and not a portable. They just want to get to their homes at the end of the day in a reasonable time. I stand before you frustrated, disappointed, but not irrational. Some of you in the past expressed your desire to stop construction of apartments, while other council members sought to undermine their counterparts by tabling discussions in hopes of pushing through a deeply unpopular agenda at a later date. Please, let us not adopt the ways of governing from the other Washington. As our elected representatives, you have a duty to thoughtfully develop the remaining land for our generations to come. And if the end that means a large park for one of Mill Creek's hidden treasures, the wetlands, that would be far better than any super apartment complex has to offer the city. You have a duty to thoughtfully examine the consequences more apartments will have on the entire community. I cannot see how approval of the apartment project at the farm would be advantageous to Mill Creek. Vote now and vote against this project. Thank you.
Will Nelson, 14925 29th Drive Southeast, Mill Creek. I would echo what the previous lady just said. And to give you an example, when I was working on Three Mile Island in 04, I picked up the paper from York, Pennsylvania, think Hershey Candy Company. Pretty much what she was saying, developer proposed more subsidized housing, and they said, we've had enough of this. We don't need the cost. We're not going to support it, and they did not approve it. I would suggest you do the same on the next proposal.
Right along. Next up is our capital improvement plan study session.
Bob. Thank you, Mayor. This is actually a consideration for you this evening for adoption of the capital improvement plan. Last time we met on October 9th, staff presented you the revised and updated capital improvement plan for 2019-2024 and included 27 projects at a cost of approximately, or actually at $19,270,140. I want to note that the CIP, when it was published on Friday, was modified today, adding $285,000 to the six-year plan, and that was to reflect some project management expenses that were overlooked, that were inside the operating budget that you're going to be discussing next week, but were moved to the capital improvement plan to better reflect the types of expenses that capital improvement plans pay for. So, again, that was a $285,000 increase to the capital improvement plan over the six-year period. The way that will be balanced in the latter years, the last 2 years, would likely be either decreased use of opportunity funds or simply increased revenues that would materialize over the course of that six-year period. The capital improvement plan, the first 2 years of which are included in the city's budget, so which makes your consideration of the capital improvement plan timely and important this evening. During the study session of October 9th, I previewed for you the five major policy issues that were promoted and are embedded within the capital improvement plan. We can certainly discuss any of those policy provisions that are included in the capital improvement plan this evening. Also, during the October 9th study session, staff had heard council's inquiries and concerns and questions, as well as additional questions that you have posed to me after the meeting. And so we have accumulated 14 different issues that we have responded to within the agenda summary, reflecting again that discussion that evening and then conversations that I've held with you since that period of time. Staff's prepared, I'm prepared to address any of the issues within the CIP, any of the 14 issues that have been identified in your agenda summary, or anything that we covered on the October 9th meeting. I'm proposing that council authorize and support and adopt the capital improvement plan for 2019 and 2024. And I'll pause my presentation and remarks so I can directly answer questions that council is interested in. Right, they're just summarized within the agenda summary. I can certainly walk through those, but they're just the 14 different points. We also took care to provide you the page number on the agenda summary as to where that additional clarification has been made in the CIP, or if there was a change to the CIP, the page number of that change. Many of those 14 points were simply providing clarity how a certain project could move forward. For example, the Hawk project, a concern and a question about how that would move forward and whether or not council would have another say in moving that project forward. And of course, the answer is yes, because of that is a public works. And we staff heard loud and clear council's interest to reach out to Snohomish County, to reach out to other outside funders that could help reduce or eliminate the city's contribution. And before that project moves forward to implementation or construction, staff will bring those efforts back, and then you'll be able to make the final decision as to whether or not that project moves into construction. But there are many of those types of clarifications that were made in the agenda summary and then also further embedded in the capital improvement plan. Yes.
We haven't really had the thorough discussion.
Yeah, phase two, correct. The CIP is focusing on phase one, and of course, any purchase of any property, again, requires council authorization for a purchase and sale agreement. So there are a number of steps for implementation of any of the projects within the CIP plan.
Forward with the budget, but we haven't had thorough discussions. So I appreciate making the changes that you did.
I have a question for the five of us on 19-PW06, the Pavement Preservation and Rehabilitation Program.
Page number
37. The question goes back to our discussion earlier this year with Let's Get Round to It. And if you look at the second line, it refers to typical work will include crack filling, removal and replacement of failed pavement, patching, surface preservation treatments, parentheses, seal coat, slurry seal, microsurfacing, chip seals. Do we need to make some kind of statement in here about chip seal and that it, and I don't know what that statement is, that it's our least preferred alternative? Or I'm just throwing it out there whether or not we need to make a statement in the CIP based on the discussion of what we heard from the citizens earlier this year that they do not want chip seal, particularly within the neighborhood. So
they didn't like chip seal in the neighborhood, but chip seal on Dumas Road was a good project.
That's discussion is should we have a statement to something to that effect? I don't know if there's right answer or not, but
was it the actual product or the application? I thought essentially our issue is with the application.
I think it's my sense is it's a little bit of both, and it varies by situation. We had a different result up in Heatherwood West than we had down in the south part of town. But I'm not sure the residents in Heatherwood West, even though an engineer might say it was a better application, I don't know that the citizens think it's better. So I'm not suggesting a statement that says, no, we won't use it, but I'm wondering if we should put in that it's
a,
where appropriate and that it's in the neighborhoods, it would be a last resort alternative or something to that effect.
Or maybe without getting specific, just it's the appropriate preservation technique for the type of road it is. Because in residential areas, we don't want to use the urban, the suburban kind of, or the rural kind of chip seal. But on arterials, it may make a lot of sense. Same thing other places, too. So is it, instead of saying typical work, is there some way to say that pavement preservation techniques appropriate to the location and traffic use of the roads will be, might include these kinds of things or something like that. It just says there's a range. Because we have a range of kinds of roads we're going to preserve under this program. We have a range of kind of techniques we want to use.
Yeah, and I'm open to the staff coming up with some language. I just thought it might be appropriate for us to convey in the CIP that we heard what the citizens said earlier this year regarding chip seal, and we're taking that into account. We're not saying absolutely no in under any circumstance, but so.
Councilmember Cavallari?
If we're done with the chip seal discussion, I'll make a comment.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any ideas for, I mean, obviously it was a bad situation.
My thoughts on that is that prior to making a $750,000 investment that may be controversial for the city, I would like to check in with council before moving forward with a specific technique, especially if I know that it's been controversial in the past. So I'm very aware of the history with chip seal. I'm sensitive to that. And I know the city is too. So prior to proposing such a technique, I would definitely do a check-in with council prior to an investment.
But do we need language in this to make that more clear that that needs to happen, or is this enough? I guess is what
right.
Councilmember Holzclaw
is asking. Somebody else looking at this isn't going to know that you're going to do that. So do you have some verbiage that we can put in here that says that we will...
Could be something to the effect chip seal is not the preferred alternative for neighborhood or neighborhood roads, but may be appropriate in higher use arterials, or the engineers can come up with something.
I was going to suggest could be something similar to our outside of a typical overlay. Staff will discuss any alternative preservation techniques with city council prior to bid and award. Obviously, you control the award as well, the process, but something like that, I think, would probably cover your concern.
I'm not...
If you provide the approval, then...
You do.
Yeah, then we can, you know our feelings, and be prepared if you come to us with a chip seal.
But certainly easy for us to identify and provide that sort of clarity within the document itself.
Is that wording okay with you, Brian?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's important that we convey somehow through this in just a few words that what we heard and that it's not our preferred alternative in the neighborhoods and we're going to try to avoid it where we can.
Okay.
Thanks, Mayor. First, thanks, Bob, for getting back to me on all my questions that I sent you. I appreciate that. What I would like to discuss is I still am on the fence and probably oppose the language of the opportunity fund. Description that it simply is just another vessel or opportunity to maybe use these discretionary funds in lieu of reserve funds when we're capping reserve funds just still kind of rubs me the wrong way. So I'd like to have a further discussion about that or see why everybody's in favor of it, at least.
Is that also a fund where money can't be spent without council approval and discussion?
That is correct. That is a prerequisite for spending any of those funds. And the intent, as Councilmember Cavallari has noted, is to pay for unknown expenses that you might experience with a project that you approved or a project that was anticipated when you developed the CIP, both of which then still require the council's approval before moving it out of that opportunity area and into an actual allocation of a project.
Is that
I'm just troubled. I think that it, if you see money in a certain pot, there's the need to want to use it. I think the word discretion is in there. Staff, general fund counsel will have the discretion to utilize these funds. I get all that, but I just think if the opportunity is there to use them, we're going to spend them. It's just, you know, just the way people are.
I will note that there are some cities that utilize opportunity funds and differently than the way we've programmed it. We've allowed it to be used for any of the three major focus areas that you have, but others use it differently in that they would assign a certain level to a certain area of program focus, whether it be parks and recreation or some other element that they're trying to create a sustainable and larger pot of money of which, when you save, could have a larger impact during that six-year period, rather than, you know, continually trying to simply balance and spend every dollar that you have assigned to the CIP, which typically would happen. You'll look at your revenues, and usually then you allocate all those dollars back into a project. So the Opportunity Fund provides you with an opportunity, whether it's one focus area, two or three, to save longer term so that when a significant opportunity arises during that six-year period, you have an available source of money to which to rely upon.
Yet we're talking about maybe capping or even pulling back the amount we keep in reserve to simply create this fund. That's where I have a little trouble.
I'm going to surmise that I think part of what the reaction here is this opportunity fund. I view this as a capital projects contingency reserve. That's the way I look at this, is that because we got a biennial budget, we only come to this every 2 years, things can come up during the biennium and or project costs can get out of hand. And so this gives us, this is just sound fiscal planning to say, let's hold back 10% rather than program every dollar we expect to come in towards a specific project, and then getting to the point halfway through a biennium where we're going like, we can't do that project, we can't do that, or we've run into a need, and having to go back to, okay, now where do we find that? So I'd be happy in other sectors of finances to say there's just a contingency in the bottom. It's 10%. That's a pretty reasonable number. So I'm happy with it, but maybe it's a contingency reserve as opposed to opportunity fund if it's the spin on the name that's bothering people. Thanks.
Bob, where in here is it defined what the opportunity fund would be used for?
Several places. The first is on page 4, which is just the summary or letter from me that describes, but later in the document too, it's picked up again in the physical policies. Page what? Page 8, I'm told, from the gallery here. Yeah, page 8, bottom of the right-hand corner. So it can be used to support transportation, parks, and trails, and city facilities and equipment.
What does that mean? Because I agree with Councilmember Todd. I think part of the problem here is the name.
I think it's exactly, I mean, whatever you call it is not of importance, I believe. But it does serve as a contingency. It does serve as a reserve that you could utilize for either increased project expenses for a project that you've already programmed in the CIP and approved, or a project that wasn't realized until, you know, after the CIP was adopted or modified.
Or Peggy, even though she's conservative in her estimates of the revenues, is off by 10%.
That is the other use for that as well.
Because it's a biennium we might miss on all of a sudden the real estate market tanks and nobody buys or sells anything, that REIT fund drops.
So it could be a project reserve, it could be a project opportunity fund. Again, the name, I don't know that it's important, but the intent was just to provide a pot of money that you could access if needed and desire.
So essentially you're basing the capital facilities that's relying on the REIT on 90% of the projections instead of 10%.
That's correct.
So the bucket's a little, going to Councilmember Cavalier's comment, we're actually making the bucket a little smaller and just setting aside some not for opportunities, but it's contingencies. And I think that's what I'd rather call it, a contingency fund. I think that I understand where Vince is coming from. I think it's opportunity fund suggests it's a pile of money there that someone can find an opportunity and dip into it and take that money, but it's not really what I'm hearing the intent is for.
No, it's not to create a manufacture an opportunity just simply because there's money. It's to access if you have the need.
Being more conservative.
We've just kind of talked about it, and it's a lot less in this fund than what we are reducing the reduction to our reserve fund is a lot more than what we have in this.
That is correct. One of the policies was to transfer one-third of the general fund reserve that's above 15% of the biennium, and that in itself is a policy change. It actually creates more reserve for you because the previous policy language was 15% of the annual budget, although you never really tested it and calculated it because you always had something greater that existed. But once you transfer that money out, you're still residing with a 21% reserve of the biennium. And that would be $5,900,000, at least what we're forecasting at this point, nearly $6 million of reserve that you have available to you for general operations.
It would be an inaccurate representation to say we're just reducing our reserve fund and moving it into a – or that's oversimplified to say we're just reducing our reserve fund and moving it into a opportunity fund because we are also – it's not all of it, right?
That's correct.
We're not just chunking it away and moving it into this one, and we still have the same reserves, but it's in two different pots, and one's called an opportunity. It's different than that, and it's a lot less.
It's much less than that. But in a sense, it is a reserve fund for your capital projects. In a much smaller amount.
We're going to call it something else. Yeah, I think the optics deserve something. A contingency fund, as Councilmember Holzclaw.
Would it be possible to add a sentence or two on page 8? Just I hear what you describe as the intent is what I assume this was for, and I think it makes sense with the change in the name to a contingency fund to deal with the optics, but I would sure help me if there was a sentence or two that said, you know, contingency for situations such as, you know, it sounds like it's, you know, projects that run over cost that are already programmed or an unanticipated project that we've got to pick up because of an emergency. I assume this would be the type of thing that would have been utilized. Could this have been? No, stormwater would have been a different issue. So this wouldn't address Sweetwater.
It would not address Sweetwater, but 35th, for example, to the extent you had enough funds, you could have supported at least in part with some funds here. And the description now is that it's subject to council discretion. They can be appropriated toward currently unidentified projects, toward approved projects that are underfunded, or towards unexpected increases in planned projects.
With the change in the name, I think that accurately reflects what the intent is. I think those would be good changes.
James, is there a sound coming across the
room? That gets us home. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to had good discussion with the city manager, and I'm just going to say it here for the benefit of others, and you can argue if you disagree. It is difficult for staff to give us numbers we're happy with, and I appreciate that. On one hand, we go, gosh, you guessed at one number, and here we are 2 years later, and it's not even close, and so we get mad about that, and I apologize when I do that. I apologize now when I've done that in the past. There's also a sense in some of these things where I go like, oh my goodness, the smell test on some of these numbers, like, it just doesn't make sense. And so I can't have it both ways, and I appreciate that. I think we need to understand that collectively, we as a council and staff and the citizens hopefully understand that this is guesses at things that are not even close to design in many cases, and so we don't really know. But I think we want this to reflect the general scope and the quality and the timeliness of projects, and that comes with a certain cost. And I'll say here and now that I understand that the cost sometimes is just is a scientific wild-ass guess. That stated, I also would like to make sure that we all look at this money as if it was our own. And so when you see some numbers, you go like, I wouldn't spend that much money on a roof, or I wouldn't spend that much money on a play structure. Those are heartfelt comments, and I hope staff takes those to heart, because it's just, at some point you got to go, wow, would I do that on my own budget at home? So make sure we're spending the dollars like they are our own, because they are our citizens' own dollars. A $250,000 for a play structure is 5 years worth of 1% tax increases, not compounded, but that's a 5% tax increase. Or it is $25 million more retail sales, which is another 15 Starbucks stores in town. So $250,000 is significant money. Yeah, and the money comes from different places, but it's significant. And so I just swallow hard when I see some of those numbers. I'm going to let them go here because these are just planning numbers, but we should not get too attached to those and come back 2 years later and say, well, we approved the CIP and it says $250,000 for a play structure at Heron Park. I am going to blow up when it comes in at $250,000 just because I think there's got to be more cost-effective ways to do that, or I'm just way out of line. And if I'm way out of line with real numbers when the time comes, I will apologize then. Thanks.
So I agree with you last week, and then I asked for a further explanation as well with the roofs, and it was a lot of it had to do with the products that were used, I think, were some of the costs. So that kind of met the bar for me on those two. It does sound excessive for such a small structure that it would cost so much. But I mean, having gotten your explanation, and I understand it now, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, and that particular structure, maybe it's a learning experience also as we move forward, the way you design structures and how complicated they are, we need to be mindful of what it costs and to replace on those kind of architectural design or custom type features that we put into our parks, because they are very costly then to replicate when you replace them. And of course, that's what we're seeing in the roof, given the architectural dimensions of that structure, doesn't lend itself to a simple approach. And we see that then in the cost estimates we get from, and we actually have quotes on many of those elements in that park were based on quotes. So a little further along than just the planning level estimate, but I think a lot of that is just simply driven by the design standard, the architectural standard that we utilized when we built the park initially.
Anybody else have any comments? Okay, so what you're looking for is approval of ordinance 2018-827, adopting a revised and updated 6-year capital improvement plan for the years 2019 to 2024 in accordance with the city's biennial budget process, comprehensive plan, and growth management act.
Along with the two modifications, Mayor, that were made this evening.
So moved.
Second.
Just to say thanks to staff. This kind of got a compressed schedule, and we appreciate that staff really worked hard to get it to this point. So this is a big improvement over what we've had in the past, and this can be a continuous improvement opportunity as we go forward. So this is great. Thanks.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, Mayor.
Now we're on to new business, Yakima County Technology Services.
I'll start with this one, Mayor, and if you have questions, staff is prepared to address questions as well. But in 2007, the city implemented a new data backup system that utilizes a primary backup and a secondary backup, and best practice is to locate that secondary backup in a geographically different location. To ensure that a natural disaster doesn't then negatively impact, again, both the primary and secondary backups. And so that's what this interlocal agreement does. It provides that Yakima County will serve as a suitable location for the city's secondary backup appliance, if you will. And staff is recommending, I am recommending, that you authorize me to execute this interlocal agreement.
Back up to Snohomish County, or is that DEM stuff?
That possibly could be DEM stuff. We have not had any backups to Snohomish County in the past.
Okay. Okay, so you're looking for a motion to authorize the city manager to execute an interlocal agreement with Yakima County Technology Services.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Item D.
Item D, Mayor. Yes, this is a study session. In fact, the next two items are study session matters, and I'm going to invite the police chief, who's going to lead us through a discussion on panhandling issues and a topic that I know has been of interest to the council and interest to this community. Chief.
Thank you, Bob. Good evening, council. So included in your packet is an agenda summary with some analysis on panhandling issues. A little background, this started with some concerns we received here at the city about some ongoing panhandling issues in town and some of the behavior associated with what were perceived to be homeless folks looking for handouts. And this prompted some internal discussions about the behavior related to the panhandling, and if it was aggressive or if it was intimidating behavior. Was there some mechanism in place for us to perhaps take some more aggressive approach with enforcement in those issues? We looked at a coercive solicitation ordinance that some cities had on the books. But as I started to get into doing the research, reached out to Arlington, and they have this coercive solicitation ordinance on their books, but they're not enforcing it because they ran into some concerns about some of the First Amendment right issues associated with panhandling. So I dug a little bit deeper and got into the MRSC resource materials and really identified that our problem surrounds four primary issues that I've outlined here: homelessness in general, panhandling, public sleeping, and traffic interference. And we're obviously not alone in this challenge that we're dealing with. We heard it from audience members tonight. The issue of homelessness is impacting City of Mill Creek. But we have to be very careful as we move forward with taking any additional action, because we have to make sure that we preserve the rights of all of our community members. And whether they're homeless or not homeless, we have an obligation to preserve those rights. So this agenda summary includes some analysis on those four issues, which I think are really pertinent to the conversation. I've cited in the agenda summary some recent and current case law. The city of Lakewood has dealt with some issues. Most recently, the city of Boise, Idaho, had a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case on public sleeping. And the Ninth Circuit made a ruling on that, and I mentioned the results of that court case in here as well. The court has really established well that we shouldn't be taking enforcement action with people sleeping in public. There's a lot of analysis that goes into that. Attached to the agenda summary is a paper done by Scott Massal's office to talk a little bit about the ramifications of enforcement action on people sleeping in public. And there's considerations that need to be given about available shelters and if these folks have some different alternatives. Basically, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said it's cruel and unusual punishment to cite or arrest a homeless person if they have no other place to go. So the Ninth Circuit is Washington as well. And a lot of these court cases have really indicated to us that we need to tread very, very carefully with anything that we do related to these four primary issues. Now, that said, we have some things on our books already with trespassing and traffic interference, disorderly conduct, intimidation and harassment statutes that can help us address the behaviors should those behaviors escalate to a criminal situation. Seated on a box on the corner, not blocking traffic with a sign, is constitutionally protected free speech. But if that behavior escalates to the point where somebody feels intimidated or harassed or traffic is obstructed, then we have statutes, municipal codes already on the books that will allow us to take action should we need to in those situations. I've instructed the officers to take a social service approach first with homeless folks, should they encounter them day or night, you know, on the streets or on the trails, wherever they may be. We do want to protect their civil rights as well and afford them opportunities for assistance and help if they need it, but then also strictly enforce our trespassing laws, our no camping in city park rules, and some of these other traffic issues. But it's a issue of importance to the entire community, as you heard tonight, and I wanted to entertain a conversation with council about your feelings and seek some direction.
Thanks, Mayor. Just to kind of give a heads up or maybe a brief explanation to the public, or my view is this is certainly not an attack on homeless people, certainly not an attack to infringe on the rights or civil liberties of other individuals. This has to do with the rights of citizens that have businesses in the community, that conduct business, that wish to conduct business in the community, doing it safely and humanely. We have all received the emails here, as you have received the complaints of folks being aggressive, folks breaking out into the middle of traffic, stopping traffic, and almost causing accidents. I mean, these contribute. The reason we're having this conversation is not for any sense of insensitivity or anything like that. It's because it's necessary. There's a lot of folks being put at risk at this juncture, and it seems to be growing. And I hear the complaints daily, so I think this is a very healthy discussion, and it's more than appropriate. Thanks for bringing it up, and I'd like to hear more. Thanks.
Councilmember Steckler?
I got a few questions for you on this topic. This is something I'm very passionate about for a number of reasons. So let's I read through your study, which was great. Very helpful. Let's talk about the sleeping one first.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume that when I was reading through this piece, this is somebody at the end of a long, hard day, has nowhere to go to spend the night, and they just, you know, drop in front of QFC in the grass and spend the night. That is their right if there is nowhere for them to go.
Right.
Okay.
That's the court ruling, yes.
That's the court ruling. So... yeah, so one of the challenges here is do we have our police officers aware of where they should go? Do we have to send them there? Do we tell them to go there? Do we wake them up and say, hey, you can't sleep here. You got to go to the Snohomish shelter. It's wide open. There's beds there. What if they're intoxicated? Did that take away some of their rights in public intoxication and they passed out on the sidewalk?
So two things I want to back up to your first question about sleeping in front of QFC. It is private property. So This Boise case talks specifically about public property. So if we take this scenario and we move it to the planter strip on the street on Mill Creek Boulevard, now we're talking about what is the facts that are pertinent to this case. If somebody is on QFC property and the QFC property management company, store manager, owner says, no, I want you removed, then we will send them on their way. We'll give them a trespass notice if the property manager or store owner is willing to do that, and that would subject that person to a trespass citation should they come back. The court case talks about public sleeping on public property.
Define that for me. Are we talking about parks?
Parks, if we, in our case, we have an ordinance that says no camping in parks.
Okay.
So if it's camping, that's, you bring a tent and you set up your tent and you camp. We have an ordinance that says you can't do that. Sleeping, just picking a spot on the grass and laying down to sleep, is public property in the park. And if that person does not have an alternative place to go, then we are not in a position to take enforcement action with them.
So if you knew that there was an open bed somewhere, you could wake them up and send them on their way?
Yeah, the challenge with that is we don't have any known shelters in town, and there are shelter resources in neighboring communities, but one of the challenges Boise had in their case is they tried to get enact a mechanism where they could really keep track of how many empty beds there were in shelters, but their point in time survey revealed that there are, no matter how many shelter beds they have, there are more homeless people on their survey than there are beds available. And also the court ruled that if a lot of these shelters were church-sponsored, which a lot of them in our community are as well, if a requirement of sleeping in the shelter is that you have to become involved in whatever religious aspect occurs inside there, then that doesn't count. Can't make somebody go to a shelter and become involved in a religious activity that they don't want to be involved with. And so we run into a really difficult time at 2 o'clock in the morning identifying where there may be shelter beds available. Now, if we have that, that's the social service piece that I talked about. We will offer that. Can we help you find a place? Is there a place available? We will check those resources. And if there are, we'll offer to let somebody to give them a ride. We give rides to downtown Everett all the time to take them to the different shelters. So that's available to us. If we call all the shelters and there's no beds available and they want to sleep in on that street corner, then they'll sleep on that street corner.
So I would think in today's environment of technology, we could create the resource for our officers to be able to see if there's an availability and before they even wake the person up. But then whenever there is that opportunity, there's a bed in Everett, there's a bed in Bothell or whatever, we will wake them up and we will move them on their way or even help carry them. But the only time you're going to see somebody sleeping on our streets is if, you know, there's just no place to send them. And that's the case. But
right.
It could create that quickly. We don't have that today.
We do not have that today. And that was one of the challenges Boise experienced. They tried to put together some sort of a resource list. In the city of Boise, which is a fairly sizable city, I think there were three shelters that they had available. They couldn't really accurately track it. And I think it's going to come down a lot to how involved and cooperative the shelters want to be with keeping that information updated. I think that was one of the problems that they experienced is, staff at the shelter didn't say, hey, our beds are full or our vacancy light is on, either one. And they had a really difficult time keeping that up to speed. But I think that there's an opportunity there. I just don't know how we'd make that happen.
But that is enough. That is,
I think so.
A solution here. And I know I got to shut up here and let some other people talk, but quick questions. Blocking sidewalks and sleeping, they would be immediately removed. Sleeping during the day, same ruling?
Same rule, absolutely. Doesn't matter day or night.
Thank you. I'm going to open it up to other.
So the challenge with the trail is it's private property, but it's installed and maintained based on some sort of a development agreement, I imagine, or a permit process with the city. It's private property. What we've done with Mr. Lee and other other property owners is we work with them to preemptively get a trespass notice. So we will approach the property owner and say, hey, listen, here's basically a blank form that says you do not want unauthorized people camping, sleeping, inhabiting your property. And we have them sign that form. We keep that form on record. If we encounter somebody on one of those pieces of property, we will remove them based on that. That way we don't have to wake them up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, you know, somebody's here on your property. Do you want them gone or not? So we've done that with Mr. Lee and a bunch of other property owners to keep them out of there. His concern is the access, how easily accessible his property is because of the trail. But we did... Friday afternoon went and there were no one around. You come back on a Sunday night, there may be somebody around. And so we incorporate those types of proactive patrols into being out and about. And if we encounter somebody on Mr. Lee's property or somebody else's property that has an advanced trespass notice, we will exclude them from the property. We typically take a less aggressive approach with that as far as enforcement, unless it becomes a repeat problem with the same person. We'd like to just move them along, as Mr. Lee did. We don't pay them $50, but we'll move them along. And if they come back, then we'll step up our level of enforcement action.
So when he calls, you will come?
Yep. Yep. We've been very responsive with Mr. Lee and his concerns, but his frustration is on a little bit different level than the presence. I think his concern is the trail.
More of if someone would he be the responsible party? Sure, that's a piece of it, but. Yeah, I agree with the mayor.
His concern is the liability. I've talked to him several times, and his concern is that liability, but not just that. It's also his property, and he is responsible for cleaning it up and the garbage that is left behind. If we have an opportunity to encounter somebody in a tent with a bunch of things, we have them pack up their tent and their bunch of things, and they leave. But more often than not, all we discover are remnants of a camp. And then that's unfortunately on the property owner to clean and maintain the property. And that's an ongoing issue on Mr. Lee's property.
Ryan was next, I think.
comment and a question. The comment is, I'd like to see more information on Mr. Lee's circumstance. I'm interested to know why it was a pathway to nowhere was required of him however many years ago that was. The question is, where are we? Is his situation unique? I know we've have some issues in Cougar Park back in the woods. Now I'm hearing about it down there. Are there other places? Are there other places like Mr. Lee where this problem is occurring on private property?
There are. There's a section of undeveloped property on Dumas Road on the south side across from the new entrance to Arena Sports next to Mill Creek Sports. Undeveloped piece of property there where we will occasionally encounter a homeless camp. Again, the property owner there is lives out of the area but has been helpful with us. We've done criminal investigations that have led us to there, and so on more than one occasion we have dismantled camps and or taken enforcement action with folks that are there. But again, the problem there is identical to what Mr. Lee experiences with transient camps, which by their nature are transient, so they come and go.
When you say camp, how big? I mean, people nowadays, I picture when you say homeless camp, I think downtown Seattle coming under I-5 where you've got hundreds of people.
No, what we see in our undeveloped areas are a tent or two and a blue tarp and then the various accoutrements that go with that. And it's usually, you know, one or two or three people. Most recently, the camp off Dumas Road was part of a criminal investigation where some property crimes had led back to that. It was three tents. And if you were to go camping with, you know, a family of five and you'd set up three tents and you'd have things around, that's kind of the scope of what we're talking about. Not anything like you see under an overpass in Seattle.
Besides the woods in Cougar Park, has it been a problem in the parks themselves, or people can't, you use the word camping, are we finding people sleeping the night in Pine Meadows Park out on the fields, or?
No, Cougar Park, we just, within the last 2 days, ushered somebody along who'd set up a camp in Cougar Park, actually had family nearby and a place to stay, so it was easy to usher them out of where they were and back to where they came from. But as far as just kind of sleeping in the middle of the parks, most of our parks aren't attractive to setting up homeless camps because they're pretty much wide open. Cougar Park is unique because of the undeveloped portion of that, and this individual didn't access Cougar Park through the developed part of the park. He came in from 35th past the church property. So as areas develop, there's less places for these camps to pop up. But we don't have a challenge like Seattle or Olympia is experiencing right now.
My last question before... Councilmember Todd, are we seeing this in the nature preserve?
We've gotten a couple reports in the last 6 months of camps in the nature preserve, and again, those seem to be very transient, maybe somebody spending the night or two. We'll get a report. I think I saw something in the camp, looked like a tent. We had one in a piece of property that we were convinced that there was a homeless camp, but it turned out it was a couple of Mylar balloons stuck to a tree that just popped out of the sky. So, occasionally in the nature preserve, we'll get reports, but we have not discovered a real camp.
Thank you. So we've got rules about our parks, which are, we just talked about, fairly well defined. We also have trails, which I think are separate, or are they linear parks? Like, is the North Creek Trail Corridor, is that a park as far as you guys are concerned?
Yeah, we interpret that as a park. That's a piece of park property.
Okay.
Yes.
Then I think what Mr. Lee was talking about, and it exists several places, is a private property has been asked to give a public access easement, which then becomes part of our trail system, to give the public access across a piece of private property. And is that part of our, that really still owned by owner? I guess that maybe that's a legal question we should look into, is what's the liability,
right,
as he referenced, and what is your capability to enforce our linear park rules or trail rules on that private property? It's not like that's...
So from our approach on that piece of property, is this is privately owned property by Mr. Lee, and if he wants people removed from his property as trespassers, we will do that at his request. I would defer to Scott, and it may require a little research to see how that works out with a trail we asked him to put in. I don't know.
It seemed like it'd be worth looking at, because, you know, a trail, there's certain things you can enforce on a trail, like somebody riding a motorbike on a trail. You guys probably have a rule against that. A public access easement, I'm wondering if it is not as clear, and the liability issues and things like that. It's probably
I don't even know that this little section of paved trail is on a trail map or considered a city trail. I don't know. We just view it as Mr. Lee's private property, and we help him out when we can.
Yeah, and Mr. Lee is one of them, but I'm thinking the Nature's Landing has got one of those, and Montero Apartments has one that's the benefit of whatever it was to get over the Safeway. There's a bunch of these around that became Rivendell. Yeah, Rivendell was concerned about the Montero people accessing Safeway across Rivendell, but that was a public access easement issue. There's a bunch of these.
Oh, I was just trying to be responsive to the comments that I've heard. So we can certainly look at Mr. Lee's property origination documents and see what the nature of the access is from a legal perspective. I know there's also what's called a recreational use immunity statute, and I don't remember all of it off the top of my head, but fundamentally, if an entity, a city or a private individual holds their property out for recreational use, state law protects them from lawsuits and damages that arise from that. There are some limitations on it. I haven't looked at it in a while. We'll take a look at that and double check it. In the course of the conversation, you've identified a no camping in city parks, and so I'm going to double check that and make sure that that's consistent with the Boise case, so that we're not out on a limb there. So we're happy to work in and with the chief and figure out the limits of the city's authority, as well as, you know, the things that the city can do to solve this problem. It's an endemic problem, and it's frequent in lots of cities that I work with, and so you're not alone. But it's not easy to solve, that's for sure.
Well, it to go to the extreme and the crazy, but there's probably some reason you can't call a right-of-way a park. But that's the, you know, what is the definition? At some point, you know, can a city create lots and lots of little parks that squeeze out the area where camping overnight can happen? You can't go to the whole right-of-way, I'm sure, but is there...
I understand what you're saying, but don't forget what the chief said earlier, which is it kind of depends on the character of the person that's doing the sleeping. If they set up a tent, that's more typically associated with camping, but if they just have a sleeping bag or a blanket and they lay down to sleep, that's more like the Boise case. And so our ordinance wouldn't really matter in that instance. But I'm going to look at those limits and see what we can do. you know? Yes.
There is no definition in the code. I looked.
Yeah, no, there's not. It's a Webster's dictionary, and then left completely to interpretation by whichever court or judge hears the case. You know, I included kind of in summary, in my agenda summary, some things that we need to make sure that we're doing, and some of those go along with working with Scott's office, make sure our trespassing statutes are defensible, and our camping statute. MRSC just on the 1st published a little brief on are your camping ordinances constitutional, and based on the assessment of the Boise case, too. So we'll want to look at that to make sure that we have defensible ordinances. A lot of these cities have spent a lot of time in court with a lot of different people and had their ordinances overturned because of the court rulings. Washington State interprets a lot of these, a lot of case law pretty liberally, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals obviously does too. I also included as a bullet point here to proactively work with our business and homeowners associations. The comment was made about the nature preserve. We work with MCCA, and we have these types of trespassing issues. We can deal with those because we have that relationship. And make sure that our police department staff are equipped with what they need, knowledge and or resources and or equipment or just the ability to be able to get out there and get after it.
Councilmember Steckler, and then Cavallari.
So one of the comments you made was, you know, and I've heard it from so many people, the good news is the homeless situation isn't as bad as it is in other cities.
Right.
But I can remember when we had no homeless situation here, and you know, and I can remember when Seattle had no homeless situation, and it starts and it breeds and it grows. So no matter we don't have much, we're going to have more unless we, you know, attack it now. So I want to talk about panhandling. I looked at your information on panhandling, which is my other concern, and it goes back to one issue was we have a number of panhandlers right now that are blocking sidewalks, specifically in wheelchairs and other apparatus. And one time there's a gentleman who spends quite a bit of time outside the Union 76 station down by 164th, and I did manage to see him sitting in his wheelchair, and a lady came down the street with a double stroller. And he couldn't move out of the way for her, and she couldn't get across the grass, so she had to go back down to the corner and cross at the light and go down the other side, which I thought, that doesn't seem right.
It's not.
So we can, police can go in as panhandlers, are panhandling on our street corners and our sidewalks, which are clearly blocking the sidewalk. They can't stay there. Can you ask them to move?
Right, so it's...
Where would they go?
Right, across the street to a different street corner.
Yeah, where would they not be blocking?
Well, you know,
maybe inside the parking lot.
Blocking is going to, yeah, you'll see that as well in different parking lots. Blocking is subjective, left to interpretation, because perhaps a double wide stroller with the twins can't get past, but a single human being on 2 feet can get past without.
As long as they're willing to walk into the grass.
Yeah. Right. I'm very familiar with the panhandler you're speaking of. I've not seen that person blocking the sidewalk to the point where nobody could get past. So it's a little bit subjective, and it has to be. It's not something that we can take enforcement action on after the fact. It's something that has to occur in our presence for us to take enforcement action on it. So we would need to see that violation occur to be able to take enforcement action on it.
I totally agree. I just think it would be great if our police is out there. When people are blocking the sidewalk, I'd like to see them take action against that. I'm interested in making this as difficult as possible.
Sure.
And not difficult for our citizens. I want them to not be encumbered by panhandlers. The next thing I read about your the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the freedom of speech, which explains why all the signs say, I'm homeless or I'm a vet. It doesn't say, give me a buck. It
right.
says, you know, I'm just there to express a speech about myself. And so we can't stop that. Get it. What I was curious about is, in your research, is there any ordinances ever where it people can panhandle, but we don't really want to have people encourage or enable these individuals, so we pass an ordinance not allowing people to give money to a panhandler, but instead give money to a homeless fund that the city is going to maintain and give them opportunity to make deposits. But in short, make it an ordinance in our city where panhandlers, you shouldn't pay them. You can't pay them. So it'd be a great thing when somebody says,
sure,
you any money? I'd love to, but it's against the law. Can't give you any money.
I didn't find any city that enacted a municipal code that made it against the law. I did find several cities that took it on as a resolution that we would like to put up signs and we would encourage folks to, or discourage individual donations to panhandlers and encourage donations to groups or social services. But I didn't find, and perhaps Scott, you may.
Maybe that's something Scott could look into for us.
And I did not see that. And I would be a little concerned about such a thing.
Yeah, I'm happy to look into that. I suspect it's as much freedom of speech to hand someone a $5 bill as it is for somebody to ask for a $5 bill. But I'll look at it and see. But that's probably the reason why there's not a lot of ordinances and why the solution is trying to educate people that there are better ways to spend your $5 than to give it to this guy that's on the street.
And that's not going to end homelessness.
It's not going to end homelessness or panhandling.
The $50 guy at the trail, he's telling his buddies about a great gig. You can go over there.
That's what I was thinking,
too.
Got to
give me $50 to leave. So that's enabling. I support anything that the city does to make it difficult in our city to panhandle. I support that 100%.
We talk about balance a lot, and there's a very delicate balance for
I heard Vince open with the balance.
Yeah,
over here.
For myself and the police officers here, there's a delicate balance. And we have an obligation to protect the civil rights of everybody, and we want to be very, very careful. It is balance. It really is, because the property owners and the business owners have an expectation of a clean, safe place to be able to live and conduct business, but those constitutional rights extend to somebody who doesn't own a business or own a home as well. And we have to balance that.
100% support, not violating anyone's civil rights as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Mayor. I'll be quick. One of the best ways to combat that I've ever seen is to have boots on the ground. So if there are not enough boots on the ground, there are not enough patrols, something we're not doing, I would certainly be open to hearing. Definitely necessary. We have been, whether it's us bringing on the bikes, whether it's us, you know, having volunteers or citizen patrols, but supplying them with the proper vests and flashlight to get out there, and if they're willing. I know we put the academy on here, so, I mean, there's a lot of tools in the toolbox that we can definitely access. And if it all involves coming up with Plan B, I'd like to start doing that. I think it's starting to become, as Councilmember Steckler says, it's evolving into a bit bigger of a problem more and more, and it's not going away anytime soon. So it's definitely a worthwhile discussion. I appreciate you putting this together. It's a good conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Possible to, do an article in one of our magazines that say, please don't, you know, what the story is, and maybe giving money isn't helping?
We could certainly look at doing that. I think
something about this.
We can certainly do an education piece about the societal issue and then how we're addressing these issues.
Educational piece.
I think part of the education is what Chief just told us tonight, the things we can't do. A lot of people are like, why don't you just chase them out of here? And the answer is, it's constitutional rights.
This, for me, started with an email a few months ago asking if I could just outlaw homelessness. No. The short answer, no, I can't. But it's certainly worthy of these discussions.
I think Councilmember Cavallari kind of touched on it with the Citizens Academy and stuff. I'm thinking back to some of the homeless camp cleanup projects that I've seen talked about in the newspaper, like over by Home Depot. They had a big cleanup because it was a huge camp over there, a lot of drug activity, et cetera, like that. And people came out to help. You know, volunteers came out to help clean those things up. And so I think there are people in our community that if you said, hey, we've got to clean up, and we're going to clean up, and I don't know how you do it on private property, but I think just safety in numbers or fun in numbers or whatever, a group that is going to go out and clean up whatever's going on in Cougar Park or whatever's going on Mr. Lee's property or whatever on the North Creek Trail gets activity out there that makes it less attractive for somebody to decide that's where I'm going to camp out or hang out. It would give us a chance to kind of not fight back, but help do something in our community that's pretty insulated to try to help out with the visual impairment, at least, of those kinds of things. And so if there's ways, and we got the social media, you guys got a lot of good connections through social media. Are there work parties? I just did a work party for noxious weeds over the weekend. If somebody said there's noxious, if somebody said there was a work party for noxious trash cleanup, I would go do that. If it was a group of folks, or tell me where it is, and maybe I'll do it by myself in the broad daylight. But I think, you know, asking people to help might be part of the education as well, as an opportunity to do something.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chief.
Next up is item E, an ordinance updating the City of Mill Creek Traffic Mitigation Fee Program 2018.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to have our Public Works Director introduce our consultants, who's going to run us through a presentation on our impact fee proposal.
Thanks, Bob. Good evening, Council. A few items to provide a little context before I have Pratit come over to the microphone. Traffic mitigation fees are fees that are charged to developers based on trips that are new trips that are generated with their development. For the City of Mill Creek, we use PM peak hour new trips, and our current fee is $3,000 per PM peak hour trip. That was established in 2011, and at that time, Pratit developed a methodology for the city. They also helped us back then, 7 years ago. The presentation that you'll see Pratit provide today is consistent with the TIP, the Transportation Improvement Plan, that Council adopted at your last meeting on October 9th. We have reached out, staff has reached out to one of our key stakeholders, which is the Master Builders Association of King and Snohomish County, in particular Mike Pattison, who is the Snohomish County manager. So prior to coming tonight with this presentation and with the proposed new fee, we reached out to him, gave him the opportunity to review the new fee and to reach out to staff if he had any questions. He acknowledged receipt of the letter and understanding of the new fee, has not reached out to staff, was invited tonight if he had any comments. I don't think he's here tonight. Just wanted to provide that context. And last but not least, this proposed new fee is also applicable to the ILA that Council approved with Snohomish County at the last council meeting. So there's a formula in that ILA that incorporates the proposed new fee. So with that said, I will invite our consultants Pratit, in particular Peter Duvald and Mike Hendricks, who will be providing tonight's presentation. Peter, you can use the clicker or the arrows.
Thanks, Gina. Appreciate it. Well, thank you, Council, for inviting us here tonight to talk about the update of your transportation mitigation fee. And as I go through the presentation tonight, feel free to interrupt me as I go along, because occasionally we'll go into a jargon element, which may or may not, it's obvious sometimes to us in the transportation world, but not always obvious to everybody else out there. So with that, I'm Peter DeBolt. I'm a principal at Pertit. We're headquartered in Everett. Mike Hendricks is the one that actually did a lot of the work associated with this. And so if we get any particular details, he'll probably better able to answer those. But as Gina mentioned, this is just an update of what we did several years ago for the city. It's just updated to reflect current costs of the program in terms of the TIP and some of the projects that are in it, recognizing there's been some changes in the number of trips that are being generated from development in the community, and the effects of that that has on the traffic mitigation fee program. So with that, there's four major points I want to go through tonight. It's just a definition of what is a transportation mitigation fee, what does it do? Secondarily, what are eligible projects for use in a TMF, or the Transportation Mitigation Fee Program? What the process we use to develop that of this revised fee that you'll hear about tonight? And finally, what's the results of that analysis and what we're recommending as the new fee structure here in Mill Creek? So the first point, what is a traffic mitigation fee? And very simply, it's a fee paid by developers in the city of Mill Creek to address growth that they are going to create and the impacts that creates on the transportation system, again, here in Mill Creek. And its intent is to have development fund system-wide improvements equally. So in other words, what we're saying is that if you have a development anywhere in town, that the impacts of that is going to be the same as whether it's in the north part of town, south part of town, east part of town, or west part of town. So it's shared equally. Mill Creek is a fairly small city, so it's easy to do that. You go to much larger communities, and they may have zones for their impact fee pieces. Not here in Mill Creek. We didn't think that was the appropriate way to go. There are, though, at times, site-specific improvements that developers are required to do in conjunction with their development. Maybe they have to have a left turn. That's done under the city's SEPA abilities, so that is separate from the traffic mitigation fee out there. Question often comes up, what types of projects are eligible for these traffic mitigation fee funds? Simplistically, it needs to be thought of as it's a the funds are used to implement improvements in the transportation system that are required because of growth. You can't use a traffic mitigation fund to address an existing safety problem, for instance. You can't use it to address a mitigation for a pavement preservation type project that I heard you talking about a little bit earlier today. So it's very focused on, okay, as growth comes to the community, we have the developers help pay for the mitigation associated with that growth. Some of the process we used to develop the TMF here was we evaluated the costs for those needed improvements. You talked earlier today about your CIP. The TIP is just a subset of the CIP. It's focused on the transportation elements. So we took cost of projects, and there's eight of them, and it's mentioned, I think, in the memo that was distributed to you, that are part of the city's 2019 through 2024 transportation improvement program, and says, okay, there's cost for each of those projects, eight projects. Then you have to make assumptions based on those total project costs. What type of cost should be assigned to the growth that's occurring in the city? And that's where it gets kind of in the weeds, for sure, on this piece. And it's focused on a number of critical pieces. You're trying to evaluate the projected number of trips that this new development would create in the city, number one. Number two, evaluate where those trips might go on the local transportation network. So how much traffic is going to go on to, for instance, 164th, maybe if you were to pick a street. And then dividing the appropriate cost by those trips throughout the city. So in other words, if you said, okay, the total capital project cost for these transportation improvements might be $20 million, and we had 2,000 trips. You could divide the math and say not all of that would go to the development, but a certain percentage would. And that's represented by this equation that you see in front of you. It's consistent with what industry practice, and that's through the GMA here in the state of Washington. There has been a practice that's evolved that says, okay, how do we determine how much should development pay for improvements to the transportation system? There's a lot of variance amongst that. You see one city might apply a larger percentage to the growth than another agency. And I think if there was a point that people want to ever talk about, that would be a place to focus on. But it's, again, simply the capital project costs, and I'll describe what each of these elements are a little bit more as we go along, what the local trip share is, and it's divided by the trip growth. So in concept, it's quite simple.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, absolutely.
Local trip share, again, how is that calculated?
That is an attempt to figure out, okay, given all the available potential fund sources that are available to an agency, what's a reasonable amount that a development should be paying of the total project capital project cost?
Other opportunities for income.
Yeah. And we'll get to that a little bit here in a few moments. Specifically, here in Mill Creek, we assumed it was 42%. Why 42% rather than 40 or 45? It's a range. And we were trying to make some assumptions about, okay, how much total dollars we thought need to be generated, and that's where we drove the 42% from. For in general purposes, here in the region, you see most agencies somewhere between 30 and 50% for that particular factor out there. So you're right pretty much in the middle of the range. The total TIP growth-related project costs are just a shade under $40 million, $39.92. Right? So using that first part of the equation you saw earlier, it's simply 42% of almost $40 million, 16.6. 16.7. The other part is only a certain amount of trips are being using Mill Creek Transportation System are actually generated here. There's a lot, and I think Gina mentioned earlier, you have an ILA now with Snohomish County that recognizes some of the trips using city streets are generated by growth outside the city. What we're focused on tonight is, okay, what are the trips that are generated within the city that are using the city transportation system that need to help to pay for improvements on the city system? And we use Puget Sound Regional Council, that's the acronym for PSRC, to determine, okay, on the city street system, how many are locally generated out of it? And it's a 36.5% if you look at the corridors that PSRC provides us data for on it. Okay. With that, the planning department here at the city has determined they anticipate 14 new developments within the city in the six-year horizon that we've been looking at, generating a total of about 1,550 new trips during the PM peak hour. That's one of the things I didn't mention earlier, is this impact fee is based on PM peak hour trips. Okay. So if you compare it to other cities, not that many new trips are being generated in Mill Creek compared to some other cities in the region. And this map, and it's probably hard for you to see here, but it should be in your packet, illustrates those different developments that are generating these trips. So they're highlighted in blue, scattered around the city. For the, you know, when you apply all the math to this, you end up with a number of about $3,900. And frankly, that's what we're recommending right now. So we're going from a $3,000 per PM peak trip to $3,900 is our recommendation right now. And that puts you right about the average of the city of Bellingham had done some research here a year ago, tried to research across western Washington what the range of costs are for PM peak trips. And it ranged, I think, from a low of a little more than $700 in Kitsap County up to a high of over $10,000 in the city of North Bend. So this number puts you right about in the middle of it. It's just in summary, we're at 3,000 now. We're recommending going to 3,900. So pretty simple.
Is this a one-time fee from the developer, 3,900 times 1550?
Yeah, and each developer is different. So one developer might have 100 PM peak hour trips, so it'll be 3,900 times their trips. Oh, their development is
broken out.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Based on what they...
Yeah, they're a percentage of it, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So. Any other questions?
Very
clear. Okay. Thank you.
That's correct. We have it on the agenda currently, Mayor, to come back on November 6th for your adoption.
Okay, moving right along. We're up to the consent agenda, which is two items. 59269 and 59272, an ACH wire transfer.
Exceptions. No exceptions.
No exceptions.
So moved.
Second. a second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Passes unanimously. Now we're down to reports. Let's see. In the last couple weeks, I have met with Dr. Singh from Edmonds Community College on how they can be more involved with our community. He's a very impressive man. Very impressive. And then last Friday, I had lunch with Dr. Cohn from the Everett School District to talk about their upcoming bond issues in schools and what have you. So anyway, that's it. Councilmember Steckler?
Just one thing to remind everyone to please take advantage of the city's free document shredding event this Saturday from 11 to 2. Bring your documents down, get them shredded. We are expecting a big turnout, and they actually changed the weather for us, so it's going to stop raining just on Saturday and start again on Sunday.
No report, Mayor, but while I'm speaking, I just want to publicly apologize to Councilmember Steckler if it seemed like I was being rude when I said I'll be brief. That was not my intent, and I thought about it after I said it, and you chuckled, and that's not how we operate here.
That's very kind of you to say that, but thank not you. Necessary, but thank you.
Oh, and Mike and I went to the AWC legislative update, and he's going to do the presentation. So, Councilmember Lee, any reports?
I think Mike will probably even talk about the opening.
Go ahead. You talk about it. Otherwise, I'll talk about everything. Go for it.
Well, Mike and I attended the opening of the Boeing, the new airport, Painfield opening. And it was a good time. There's a lot of officials there, but see it opening, get the tour of the new facility before it's open. We got the sign to do, I don't know if you ended up signing, to sign the pillar with our name before it gets painted over, so it was a really cool experience. I think it's going to be a good opportunity for our region as well, economically. There's a lot of good jobs that are going to be there, so it was exciting. Sorry, I didn't mean to steal it from you.
I
talked with Dr. Cohn and heard his spiel. And reminder, Trunk or Treat is coming up next week, sponsored by the city and Canyon Creek Church. It's here in City Hall. That's it.
Thanks. So the mayor referred to this. So the regional meeting, this ticket's in your folder in front of you. I encourage that we have these printed out. You should take them home and read them. AWC does a great job of putting together a legislative agenda for cities across the state. And so they kind of passed these out and talked about a lot of other services that AWC provides, and also an update on MRSC. Good event. There are not very many of these that are hot buttons for Mill Creek, but the Snohomish County Cities Group on November 15th will be taking this and Economic Alliance rough draft of a legislative agenda, and then working with Andrew Ballard to have a brainstorming session. And so you probably saw the email. If you didn't, look back at it. For the November 15th SEC dinner is going to be up in Everett. And if our city had a chance to weigh in, that'd be great. Or even as individuals, think about what are important issues that are going to come up in the next legislative session that we think are impactful to Mill Creek or to our region that we'd like to make sure get on that agenda. So I encourage you to come to that dinner on the 15th of November. Take a look at these. The one I'm going to point to, and the chief can help me out with this one, we had a presentation last year by Sue Rahr from the State Training, Criminal Justice Trainings Commission. In this brief in here is an important thing for cities. What's happened back during the recession, go back even further. Every time somebody pays a traffic ticket, some money goes to Criminal Justice Training Center. It was dedicated long ago when they raised the rate on traffic tickets, some certain amount of money is supposed to go there. Well, back during the recession, we as cities and counties were not hiring a lot of new officers, and the legislature took that opportunity to sweep some money out of that fund. And so although the money is going in from traffic tickets, it is not guaranteed to go towards the Criminal Justice Training Center. So every year, Sue Rahr is guaranteed like 8 classes worth of money, but she needs like 13 or 14. The number's in here. I can't remember what it is. And so every year she has to go sing for her supper and make sure the legislature gives her some money. Future legislators and existing legislators should note this. This is not right, because what happens is chief hires somebody new, and he can't get them through training for 6, 9, 12 months. That's not a good situation to be in, and that affects all the cities. And so it's important to cities that this funding, number one,
the biennial ask needs to get funded, and that's what this is about. But fundamentally, we ought to get after our legislators to not sweep money that they find laying around that they don't know what it's attached to. They have a tendency to pick it up and use it for other stuff. The Public Works Trust Fund we've talked about in the past is like that. We just got to be careful that that money that people agreed was going to go to some purpose stays with that purpose. So AWC does a great job on that, but I encourage you to read these. They're well written. This is good material. If you ever get a chance to talk to your legislator or any legislators, is a statewide issue. I see the chief. Go ahead.
And if I may, it's not just the time, the 6, 8, 9, 10 months that it takes to get somebody into the academy. That is a city expense because we are paying that person. And we're not getting police officer work out of them, but we're paying them police officer salary. And it's necessary to do that because if we don't, someone else will. And so when we get somebody on the hook, we have to hire them. So it's not just a time delay. It's actually a fairly substantial budget impact, too.
That one particular point your attention to, but think about that. If there's things that you think of that, hey, are legislative things that we should do, that we have an opportunity to advance those through our collective discussion, or we'll even take individual inputs at this SEC dinner on November 15th. Andrew Ballard is a Mill Creek guy, and he's going to help facilitate a discussion, a roundtable, sticky dots kind of exercise. So it'll be a good opportunity. Even if you're new to this, come and participate because it's going to be easy for people to work with. Another report, ST3, way out in the future, light rail is going to get to Everett. Well, the first part of ST3 project delivery is actually going on right now. If you're driving south on I-5 between Linwood and Montlake Terrace, I wonder what's going on the left-hand shoulder. They are beefing up the few places where they could not do hard shoulder running for buses, where there was a grate that was not strong enough or whatever. And before the end of the year, they're going to be done with that project. So it's going to allow buses to go to get off at the ramp for Linwood Transit Center and then never have to enter the freeway again until after Montlake Terrace Transit Center. So it's a 3-mile stretch that's going to allow the buses to kind of bypass that worst spot where the HOV lane is absolutely broken and doesn't work. And so that's an ST3 project, so we're kind of excited about that, that it's ST3 is actually some money in Snohomish County. But Community Transit is really excited about it because both Community Transit and Sound Transit buses are going to be able to get a little bit more reliable on their trips downtown, even though the traffic's getting worse. Fun fact, 40% of the people who cross the county line between Snohomish and King County during rush hour traffic, 40% of them are on buses. If those people weren't on those buses, it would take 2 more travel lanes. So we should be happy when people are willing to ride the bus to go to downtown Seattle. That doesn't affect a lot of us necessarily, but there are citizens in our community who do that. And when I take the bus down there, I'm glad I'm on the bus and not waiting in traffic. Last thing, Jared already talked about it, but the Painfield Airport. So I heard somebody today talk about it being a boutique airport. It's kind of unique that it is the only airport in the United States, the only terminal in the United States that is privately funded. This is entirely privately funded by Propeller Development Company or something or other. They put their own $40 million into it. They're paying the county for lease for the land, but it's all their money that built this, and they have spared no expense because they're going to get it back from fees from Alaska and Southwest and United. It is going to be beautiful, and we saw it kind of in its raw state. They put the paving in the parking lot the day after we got out of the way, but it's going to be really neat. It's got this neat couple of gas fireplaces, and this could be a fantastic place to come and go for flights, and so we're all excited about that, and it's going to be a great economic driver for companies who have not wanted to locate in Snohomish County because it's just too darn far to get to SeaTac. So this is exciting for Snohomish County overall. Thanks.
Can I just ask Councilmember Todd, what is the – I know they revised their opening estimate for flights.
I think they're saying early 2019. There's a public hearing next Monday night in Linwood where the FAA – I think the FAA has said – Pam probably knows better. The FAA has said they're okay for the number of flights, but there's still an environmental impact thing that has to happen. So the public comment period is next Monday. I think there's 30 days for them to evaluate that, and everybody's got their fingers crossed that it's going to go forward. They're very confident. I think they've chased all the rare species of frogs off of the site already from many years of use as an airport. Thanks.
Bob?
There is a new planning schedule, Mayor and Council, in your folders. You'll note that on November 6th, the meeting has lightened up a bit. The main event for that meeting will still be the presentation of the proposed budget and then property tax levy hearing that evening. And of course, lightening up one meeting simply means filling up other meetings as we look towards the end of the year. But I think you'll see that the meetings are starting to become a little more balanced, at least in the next five or six meetings that we hold. So I'm anticipating some of you have asked what time I think the meeting might adjourn. Those are difficult things to speculate on or project, but hopefully it'll be similar to this evening, and we'll be finished by 8 next week. It's just a prediction. It could last longer. 2 weeks, I'm sorry, November 6th.
Audience communication? Going once, twice? Okay.
Raise your hand.
Oh, your hand's up.
I thought if I was going to speak, I thought I had it at the beginning.
Press.
Ron Christensen, 2429 140th Place in Vine Maple for 35 years. So it dawns on me, this panhandling thing, seems like they're entrepreneurs. From the standpoint that they're soliciting funds. And I think about the people who come and knock on my door who have a permit or have gone through some kind of credentialing to do the same thing. And I thought, well, maybe we're looking at it differently. Maybe if we looked at them as entrepreneurs and required them to go through the same kind of credentialing process, maybe there's an idea in there. That's all.
Great idea.
Thanks.
Going once, twice. Okay, with that, we are adjourned at